This is the current federal tax developments for the week of February the 4th, 2019. Current federal tax developments are brought to you by Kaplan Professional Education and by your state society of CPAs. I'm Ed Zollers, broadcasting here from cloudy Phoenix, going over the changes that have happened this week in taxes. This week, it was quiet. The IRS went back to work, but of course, there's a lot of backlog. So we don't have a whole lot of things happening. We did have our first few court cases that came down. Nothing terribly exciting there unless you're a Lou Saban fan. We also had some limited information coming from the service, but we did have one particular item that dropped out right at the end of the week that made a one-word change to the proposed regulation under Section 199 Cap A. That's drawn a lot of interest. It did that plus a couple of other changes, but this one word is kind of interesting. We're going to discuss a court decision from the 11th Circuit that looked at a question of whether a taxpayer could say, well, I didn't realize there was an NOL carryforward election on this return that probably wasn't needed. And now I'd like to ignore that. And can I ignore that? Am I prepared to put it on without my consent and or without at least explaining it to me? So can I undo it? And we'll also talk about an article that was posted this week in Tax Notes Today that discussed the potential downside of making an election under the Small Business Accounting Method Simplification Rules if you happen to be a dealer in controlled substances, that is shorthand for businesses that are selling marijuana in states that have legalized that while the Fed still consider it to be an illegal act. So it's an interesting week for all the changes and all the things that have been happening. It's been, at least in Phoenix, I know in much of the country this past week, it was rather cold, or shall we say extremely cold. Wasn't true down here in Phoenix, so we were too far to the west to get the polar vortex. It came down a bit east of here, east and to the north, so didn't have the major problems here. We are getting ready here for our springtime, and tax season approaches, and so we're taking a look, trying to get ready for the things that are happening now. As I mentioned before, we're going to expect to have IRS guidance coming that's going to come out all through tax season. And that's going to present us with some issues, having adapting and changes occurring during tax season. And those of you here in Arizona know that we've had now a more complicated tax season in Arizona because Arizona's governor just vetoed the initial pass by the legislature of an income tax conformity rule. So we're going to have loads of fun here this tax season. That was even better with on top of all the other reasons we have here with this year. But let's get started and talk about something that did happen this week that got a lot of news coverage. A letter was written from the Senate Finance Committee's chair and ranking member on January the 30th. And that particular letter that was written, so it was signed by, the chair, in this case, Chuck Grassley, and the ranking member, Ron Wyden. They wrote a letter to the IRS suggesting that, you're just coming back from a government shutdown. You might not have noticed that, so we'll remind you of that. And because of that, you had been in discussion with professionals about this issue of the IRS for security reasons moving to ending their step of faxing transcripts to tax professionals. And the chair and the ranking member said, we are aware, and a lot of, organizations have been making them aware, that the IRS was in conversation with tax professionals about how this was going to be implemented because the effective date was coming up. And the problem is these talks were ongoing and suddenly the government shutdown hit. Now, the shutdown continued for over a month and the IRS is just now getting back up. And the committee's chair and ranking member said, we think it might be a good idea in areas where you had communications going and you were talking about things that had been kind of disrupted, that any deadlines might be pushed back. And by the way, in particular, this deadline would be a really good one to push back. If you get a letter, the IRS, you get a letter signed by both the chair and the ranking member of one of the tax writing committees, that's one you probably want to pay some attention to. And the IRS did pay attention to this one. So what the IRS wrote back and they announced on the 30th is they have agreed to delay the time frame during which they'll stop faxing transcripts. And they told us that they're going to give us a date sometime in the future before they start actually doing the cutoff. So if you've been concerned about that rule with stopping transcript faxing and you noticed that we didn't have time for anything to develop during the last month, basically the month run-up to that change happening, that's not taking place now. It's going to be delayed. That doesn't mean the IRS won't do it. My guess is for security, it's definitely coming. But it does mean it's not going to happen right now. So good news is, you know, you've got a little bit of time to still be used to the old system and get your fax machines up and running. Now let's go to the first case we're going to talk about this week. This particular case is the 11th Circuit's hearing on the appeal of a case from the tax court. The case is B versus Commissioner, case number 18-10511. The opinion came down on January the 31st, 2019. This case involved tax years from 2011 through 2014. The taxpayer had a tax preparer who prepared the returns for 2011 through 2014. The preparer, according to the opinion, made a number of errors, but a key one was made in 2013 when the preparer managed to effectively, massively overstate the loss coming to the taxpayer from a flow-through entity. And having done so, created a huge net operating loss. That net operating loss was carried back to 2011-2012. Okay, they got refunds on it, wiped out their taxes. The preparer also, you know, after that was done, they did the next year's return, which is 2014. The 2014 had another net operating loss. However, and I've seen this happen before, and I've always told people whenever I see it happen is, why are you doing this? You know, unless you intentionally have some reason not to want it to go back if there's an IRS exam. But even though there was apparently nowhere for the 2014 loss to go back, if they carried it back 2 years, the preparer nevertheless attached the election to waive the carryback period and carry the loss forward. IRS eventually, obviously, does the exam of 2013, discovers that, hey, you know, there's not this huge loss. You know, they caught the loss, said, that's not right. Suddenly there's tax due in 2012, and the IRS is going after this tax. The taxpayers, having this huge loss in 2014, said, that shouldn't be a problem. This loss from 14 can go back to 12 and wipe out the tax from that year. So really, we don't owe you anything. IRS says, not so quickly. Your 2014 return has a carryback waiver on it. The taxpayer said, well, we weren't aware that was there. You know, we didn't really understand. Nobody told us what it was. And we obviously didn't mean to do it. You know, and you kind of understand the point. If you really thought about it, there probably was no reason to do it. But nevertheless, it's there and it forces the carry forward. The IRS says, well, tough luck, guys. You know, you've made an election that cannot be revoked, that's permanent. It was on your return. By the way, it's a return you signed under penalties of perjury, and you said you had reviewed the return. That, by the way, is in the jurat. So you'd reviewed this return, therefore you're responsible for whatever's on it, and you can't claim that the preparer who put that election in there, that you weren't aware the election was there and that you didn't intend for it to be there. You know, you might have, you know, you may have missed it. You may have actually not read the return. Believe it or not, clients sometimes don't read the returns. And, you know, for whatever reason, we understand that maybe you didn't know it was there, or maybe you didn't understand the consequences of it, but you're still stuck with those consequences because you signed it. It's irrevocable. Taxpayers said, well, that shouldn't happen. You know, clearly our intent was not to waive this. They took the case to tax court. The tax court said, sorry, guys. The code provides this is a permanent election. It has no out to allow you to undo it for any reason, you know, including, you know, preparer made a mistake. It doesn't matter. That election, if on the return, is permanent. The taxpayers took their claim to the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals. The 11th Circuit Court of Appeals also said, guys, it's tough luck. You're not allowed to go back and undo this loss carryover. A couple of things we probably should take from this. First thing is, obviously, taxpayers need to review returns. You do need to talk about that with your clients. Look, I don't claim to be absolutely perfect. We certainly are trying to fix the return. But like it or not, you know, you really should look at the return. And if something's going on there, like if something we're saying we're waiving a right, you might want to ask me about why are we doing it? Secondly, if you are making elections on returns, it really probably is important to explain to the client there was a choice here. The choice I recommend you make is X. This is the reason why, but there are reasons why the choice may not make sense. Third, I think this could be a problem with this return when it was prepared. It could very well be the problem that we often get into, that Sally syndrome, same as last year syndrome. And a lot of times our staff learns, you know, that you carry losses forward. But if you want to carry a loss forward, you have to do you have to waive the election carryback. Well, gang, if you waive the election carryback, you've waived it permanently, even if a later IRS exam changes what went on. So before you would do something like that, now good news is this waiver is no longer in the law, at least for most, unless you're a farming operation or a casualty insurance company. But if you do something like this, an election, understand, first question you always has to ask yourself, do we need the election? Don't make an election, you know, that forces your hand unless it's necessary and gives a benefit of some sort. Secondly, you know, make sure the client understands what situations might exist why you might not want to have made the election. For instance, we talked a lot about 199 cap A and aggregation election, and normally aggregating trades or businesses under 199 cap A is going to be positive if it has any effect. But every so often, it would be a negative. So you need to explain to them, if we make this election, it's permanent, and this is where it might not be good if the following things happen. So do you want me to do this? We've got one, you know, once we do it, we can't change it. So understand that and be careful. You know, be very careful watching these things and make sure that you understand why elections are there. Because I guarantee it, by the way, the numbers here are not at all small. And you can bet that if this client is claiming the preparer fouled up by making these elections, and they're trying to get out of going to the Court of Appeals, I guarantee you they're also claiming damages, probably against the preparer for having done this on the return. And that suggests that there could be a big liability issue coming here. In fact, it wouldn't surprise me to discover that, in fact, the preparer or the preparer's insurance carrier is part of the reason why this was pushed all the way forward. You know, they wanted to see any way they could get this reversed without having to write a really, really big check. Because as I recall, in the second year, in the year 2014, the year in which they're not going to be able to carry the loss back, I think the loss in question was around $11 million. So this is not a small loss issue and not a small tax dollar issue. So it's going to be a very real problem in that case. And yeah, I kind of suspect that's why the preparer, you know, why we see this case moving forward, because generally you'd think there really is no way to get out of this. And the 11th Circuit confirmed that. But, you know, if you're going to be writing that big a check, you always try to see if you make brand new law, I guess is the theory. And it turns out, no, we could. Now, something that happened right at the end of the week, and interestingly enough for me, it was funny. I discovered the IRS had issued some revisions to the 199 cap A proposed regs while I was on break. Doing a webcast on Friday. So I was doing a webcast. It was a four-hour webcast, 199 Cap A. And I'd gone through the first 2 hours, and we gave everybody a break, and we took our 10-minute break. And I go and, you know, just quickly check email to make sure nothing disastrous has happened. And I discovered the IRS had issued revisions to the final 199 regulations. Well, of course, right off the top, I'm thinking, I got to check this, but 10 minutes, I don't have time to check it. So once I finished off, I went back and we took a look at what was happening. You'd be glad to know the tax Twitter was already running amok with discussions about what this meant. And there are a couple of changes in here. The IRS sent it out. And actually, the IRS describes briefly the two changes when they sent out their email notice under the GuideWire program. But if you're not signed up for IRS GuideWire, do a search on Google for IRS GuideWire. You get in there, you can sign up. These are email notices when the IRS releases something. That can be really helpful to understand quickly, so you know right away if they drop something big. So you at least can say, uh-oh, you know, there's something here. It's really going to affect my client. I probably need to look at this, right? It's important enough that this issue for my client is important. I probably better look at what the IRS just released and make sure I don't need to do something, or make sure I don't need to change the return I'm working on right now. So this came up. Two key changes made in here. The IRS made a change to, and it looks big at first, to the definition of an excess 743B adjustment. Now, for those of you going, what did you just say? That is a partnership tax concept that's in the 199 CAPA elections. And what it really deals with is if you have a 754 election in place or you make one, and somebody bought a partnership interest from another partner, or somebody, you know, inherits the interest, then the IRS said we can count what they call the excess 743B adjustment as UBIA, the unadjusted basis immediately after acquisition of qualified property for that particular taxpayer. And what they're really getting at is we're going to give you, quote, UBIA for the appreciation over what the partnership originally paid. You're going to get the standard UBIA, and it's going to run out the same time for whatever the partnership paid for the property, your share of that. But then you're going to get your share of the appreciation from the time the partnership bought the property. So usually this is going to be on a building. And you'll get that as if it's brand new property for you. And you're going to get it over probably 39 years if it's real property, commercial. And you'll get that new number as added to you. Well, they put that in the final regs. It was brand new. It was not in the proposed regs. And what they did, they went back, and what they really decided was they were way too wordy when they first told you how to compute this. So if you actually go through, and the way this reg is published, if you get the copy that I linked to on the website, that's actually this version, it actually has, you know, the change markings from Word. So it has the strikeouts, the underlines, and all those things to let you know what's been added, what's been deleted. And if you actually just pay attention to what's really there now, you'll notice that, yeah, it still works the identical same way. The examples were changed only to change wording and titles, but basically all the results are the same. So that was no big deal. But there was a one word change that got a lot of attention. In the preamble, at one point, the IRS discusses the regulations under 1.446-1D2. Why am I saying it in that much detail? Because it's somewhat important. What the IRS told us was that under those regulations, because we're looking at, the question they're looking at here is, can we have more than one trade or business? You know, we're operating a veterinary clinic and we also sell dog food. Do we have two trades or businesses here, the vet clinic, which is an SSTB, and the dog food sales, which may not be one, probably wouldn't be. Selling dog food is not, you know, a specified service trade or business. If you own a competitor to a PetSmart and you're selling dog food, then you're not an SSTB, you're just a retailer. Well, can our vet have two trades or businesses, the dog food business and the veterinary practice, and be able to get the 20% at least on the income from the dog food business, or do they just have one? And the IRS takes a look at 446 and the regulations under that, because those regulations talk about methods of accounting, but they specifically talk about if you have two trades or businesses, you can have separate methods of accounting. And under the regulations under D there, they tell us under D2, they tell us about the fact that if we could have two methods, if we have two trades or businesses, well, then you must have, and the term used in the 446 regs is, you must have books and records that are separable for the two trades or businesses. In the proposed regs as initially released by the IRS in January, that preamble word changed the word separable to separate. Now, that may seem subtle, and it is, but it was important because the regulations say later on you have to meet the 446-1D2 standards to even have a chance of having separate trades of business. Note, they don't say if you meet those standards, you do. They're just saying if you can't meet those standards, there's no way you have 199 CAPA separate trades of businesses. Well, now there's a problem. You know, as I said, they use separate. Separate books and records are effectively two separate and distinct ledgers. You know, like you have a QuickBooks file here that has the vet practice. You have a QuickBooks file here that has the dog food, right? Totally separate, own bank accounts. They each run their own, you know, ledgers. They don't intermix. Separable books and records could be a single QuickBooks ledger that, let's say, was using classes to break down the difference between the income from the vets, you know, from the vet practice and the operations that represented the dog food sales. And that would be separable as opposed to separate. Separate requires you going a step further than separable. Well, in the final regulations, you know, now they've gone back and they revised it and they struck that word separable or separate and they went to separable, which is the term in the regulations. Now, the question is, does that really change anything? And I think, unfortunately, the answer is no. A key thing is, in one example we have in the regulations of actually trying to apply this, having two separate trades or businesses. Remember, primarily this is going to be important if you have a specified service trade or business, because that's where we'd like to break them apart. Generally, like I said, in aggregation, we prefer to keep things together because it keeps the W-2 wages, allows us to use all the W-2 wages against all the income, all the UBIA with all the income. So generally, it's better to have them together. But if there's an SSTB, you know, and we're above the threshold amount plus the phase, we're beyond the phase out range, well, that SSTB is, you know, like kryptonite to Superman. It's going to kill any deduction. So now we want to break out this dog food business separately. They have an example. The easiest way to find it is to get the proposed regs and just do a search in Acrobat for Animal Care LLC. Why? It is the one example, which is, I find kind of funny. The IRS always just says A, B, you know, we have A, Inc., we have A, LLC. They actually gave this one a name, which is kind of unusual, but they did. They rarely use names. I suspect they try to avoid names because there probably is a vet clinic out there somewhere called Animal Care LLC. I'm sure that company exists. And so they want to avoid things like that, but they didn't this time. So it's still Animal Care LLC. You'll find that example. Here's the problem with that example. That example, and the good news about that example is they find we have two trades or businesses. Well, that's good news. But the problem with that example is, in that example, Animal Care LLC keeps separate books and records for the two companies. Not separable, but separate. Number two, they have separate invoicing of customers. If you go into their business, and by the way, they're developing organic dog food. That's also key. They're actually developing the dog food, you know, doing all the research, all that stuff. So they have all this other operation going on, which is also concerning. They have separate invoicing. So if you want to buy dog food, you have to go talk to different employees and you get a separate invoice. You can't, after taking your dog in for, you know, treatment, you can't say, oh yeah, by the way, I need dog food. No. You got to go to a separate set of employees, separate desk, at least, and, you know, separately buy your dog food. Now, I see that work sometimes in, let's say, like an ophthalmologist office, an optometrist office, where they're also selling the frames. And I, you know, they may have the doctors over here and the frame guy over here. And yes, I've seen it done separately, but I don't think I ever see it done that way in a vet clinic. Yeah, if you walk in, you can just buy the dog food, but it's going to be the same people at the front desk selling the dog food as, you know, taking in the dogs. I mean, it's going to be usually the same people. Well, this case required all of that separation. If you've not seen it, this regulation exists in the final regs at 1.199A-5C1IIIB. That's how deep we get. That's where that example is. That suggests, though, that we have to have a lot more going on. And it would otherwise seem we would have to have going on to get separate trades or businesses. That's a potential big problem. So fundamentally, it still seems difficult to separate businesses. So, you know, pulling something off of an SSTB is still difficult. Certainly, I guess, theoretically now, we don't necessarily have to have two ledgers. But this example suggests we still need a whole lot of separation. The IRS is still looking, apparently, per this example, to have two separate trades or business, they're really looking at like having truly separate operations. Will that hold up in court? We'll have to wait and see. You know, will the courts go that far or not? The regs on the reg text itself never goes that far, but the example clearly does. So that's going to be one of those things. And it's something that I said in my webinar, I've said in webinars, we're not going to know the answers to a lot of these questions, and you've just got to be able to live with this, right? You know, to quote that Eagles tune on their reunion, you know, the old line of get over it. Well, get over it. You're going to have to deal with uncertainty for the next 5 or 6 years. If you're looking for a solid answer that tells you for sure what you can do, it just doesn't exist. And anybody who tells you it does, well, yeah, they also have a bridge in Brooklyn you might want to buy. So we'll just put it that way. Next up, now we're going to talk. There's a real interesting article this week. We didn't have a lot of development, so there was an interesting article that got written, because I'm sure Tax Notes Today is having the same problem I'm having. It's like, you know, you got to fill some space, and, you know, there's not a whole lot coming out of the government agencies to talk about. So they went and they got an article written on this, which is kind of interesting. The article was penned by Nathan Richmond. Its title was Small Business Inventory Accounting Exception May Not Fit Pot. By the way, marijuana free, you know, marijuana legality, it's kind of funny. It's become a hot topic. And it's become a hot accounting topic, which is kind of interesting too. Tax Notes Today has it, you know, is where it's at. It was in the February 1st edition. And your electronic citation, if you get TNT, is 2019 TNT 22-5. What they discuss in this article is a straightforward problem. If you are selling controlled substances, okay, regardless of whether the state says it's legal or not, you know, in many states now we have free all, in many states we've even gotten rid of the whole medical marijuana deal. That was the way we first came into this. Now recreational marijuana is legal in a number of states, and more seem to be getting ready to add it in the next year. But the federal government still considers it illegal and still considers it a controlled substance. And under Section 280E of the Internal Revenue Code, if you are trafficking in a controlled substance, the only deduction you ever get is cost of goods sold. All other expenses are disallowed. You don't even get, for cost of goods sold, UNICAP, 280, you know, Section 280A, or Section, we say in this case, you know, the basically the whole UNICAP rules, 263 Cap A, don't count. Because 263 Cap A tells us that you can never use it to get a deduction you couldn't otherwise get. And so, yeah, even UNICAP doesn't apply. So, by the way, so our worry is not going to be UNICAP here. Because you might think, wait, accounting method change. UNICAP, obviously, that accelerates COG. So maybe, you know, that's our catch. You want to make that election. Nah, don't worry about that one. The real problem is all the cases in this area have looked for guidance as to what's in cost of goods sold to Section 471, the 471A, actually, and the regulations under that for whether you're a retailer or you're a wholesaler, which costs come into the mix. And the catch becomes Congress added in the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act an ability under 471C for the taxpayer to make an election and opt out of the rules of 471A, and your choice there is to treat what would have been your inventory as supplies, or to, you know, use whatever's on your books and records. Here's the key concern, especially because, you know, this law intentionally, it only doesn't touch cost of goods sold because of constitutional issues. So the question becomes, if you take 471A out of the mix, and you're now calling this stuff something other than cost of goods sold, effectively, because you're going to run it through like supplies or whatever, you know, the deal. Well, the key part is it seems very obvious that a lot of the indirect expenses that you get under 471A, and for most taxpayers, that's a negative because they end up going to inventory and it slows our deduction. But for a marijuana company, a company that's in the business of, quote, trafficking in marijuana, that's a huge positive to have it yanked into the inventory calculation, because that means it's part of cost of goods sold. A number of commentators there, and I think they're correct in this view, we're going into totally uncharted territory if a 280E, a enterprise subject to 280 Cap E, makes this election under 471C to take the, quote, simplified inventory option. We're in totally uncharted territory about what that does to the expenses that will be included in cost of goods sold. But we're pretty sure that it's going to get rid of some of them. So as they noted in the article, it would at best be premature and could be extraordinarily a bad idea for a taxpayer to make the election to opt out of 471A coverage if they are having issues with 280 Cap E, at least until we get some more guidance, which we don't really have. I mean, we have the method of changing, but the IRS has not issued any sort of binding, you know, regulations or other issues about how it's going to work, or until we have some court cases in the area, because you don't want to risk your cost of goods sold. So it's interesting, you know, you got to kind of think about all the things that may be impacted. There's a change in the law that sounds good, sounds like everybody should do it, but then sometimes that's consequences you need to think about before you pull that trigger. Remember that whole NOL issue we talked about a couple of cases back? Same basic problem here, right? There may be consequences to making this, to going ahead and changing your accounting method that the taxpayer may find less than optimal. So be careful. Well, we're coming up at the very end now. There are a few courses I'm going to be giving, two different times I'm going to be giving sessions on the 109 CAPA final regulations. I know a lot of you have been looking at those and picking those up. Your two remaining options to get it are not this week, but the following week. February 11th, I'm going to be doing a full 8-hour day. So we're going to be able to go through a lot more examples and, you know, be a little more leisurely and answer some more questions than we can. We have to do the, when we do the 4 hours or 2 hour versions. But we're going to be doing that. It'll be 109 CAPA final regulations, a deep dive into the rules. It'll be an in-person session and a webinar. So even if you're not going to be able to make it to Phoenix, you can still watch it on the web. Start at 8 a.m. Mountain Standard Time on Monday the 11th. If you think 8 hours is a bit much for you or you can't make it on the 11th, I'm also going to be doing a redone. This isn't a rebroadcast, so it's not a replay of the old version. It's a brand new version of the 109 CAPA session I did for the state of Idaho, the Idaho Society of CPAs. So we'll take a look at how it impacts 2018 income tax returns. It is a 4-hour session, primarily on the final regulations and how they work. And by the way, because it's a redone session, we will actually talk about, you know, the release of the publication 535, which came out this week. Oh, I didn't mention that. Yes, we did get the final publication 535 with a new chapter 12 that actually talks about 109 CAPA. So by the way, your tax software vendors now can actually start writing the software to calculate 109 CAPA, or at least we're going to find out what they're going to do in that regard. But that'll be in the manual. We'll also talk about that one word change and how important or not important it is. And so I'll be able to have all of that in there. And that manual, the manual for the 11th course, unfortunately was released just before we discovered the IRS was going to drop this one word change. So we'll talk about that, but it won't be in the manual. The one for the Idaho Society of CPAs, I'm going to try to get the full revised manual up there so that you'll have revised information. And certainly when we do the session, we'll talk about that. That again, the Idaho Society is going to be at 9 a.m. Mountain Standard Time on the 13th. It is only a 4-hour session, so half a day session. We'll get there. And you can sign up. You can sign up for either the Arizona site, Arizona's courses, or the Idaho courses. Go to the Society of CPAs site. Arizona Society is ascpa.com. Idaho Society is basically going to be the IDCPA. I got to remember. I always got to remember my .coms and .orgs. That one should be, though, IDCPA.org. Yes. So go to IDCPA.org. That's the Idaho Society. We also have issues with the state societies because, unfortunately, there's more than one state that begins with I. So ISCPA, you know, is one of those things. They all have that title, but it gets you to all different sites. So Idaho is IDCPA.org is how you get to them. And you can take a look at that. Okay. With that, we're basically this week finished up. So invite you back. Catch my regular updates, currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. I will post things up there as things happen during the week. And hopefully we'll actually begin to get things actually happening more significantly now we're further along. If you have any questions or comments on anything we talked about this week, you can send those to me, edzollers@currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. My Twitter handle, @edzollers, so you can follow me there, you know, and pick up things on Twitter. I do follow discussions on the Reddit group, taxpros/r/taxpros on Reddit. You know, Reddit's an interesting place and interesting in many ways. But the Tax Pro group, as I said, is well moderated. We tend, you know, they try to make sure only professional questions get up there. And it doesn't go off on weird tangents. So it's kind of nice. I also monitor discussions on the Connect sites for the Arizona Society of CPAs, the Minnesota Society of CPAs, and New Jersey Society of CPAs. So if you're a member of one of those groups, you know, if you want to post questions there, I'll try to take a look and see what goes on there. And every so often I look over in Cal CPAs Tax Talk group on Yahoo and try to follow things there. So those are all really useful resources for you to take advantage of. Make sure you do. So until next week, this is Ed Zollers from here in cloudy, but not really, but much warmer than the rest of the country, Phoenix. Hoping you have a good week, and we'll talk to you later as we see what happens with developments this year in the area of federal taxes.